KQED.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. Are evil acts perpetrated by evil people? Or can anyone placed in the wrong circumstance commit deeds they would never otherwise perform? 36 years ago, Stanford psychology professor Philip Zimbardo conducted a famous research project called the Stanford Prison Experiment that yielded some surprising answers. Now Zimbardo has probed the question of good and evil again in a new book called The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. Phil Zimbardo, our guest, after this. From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Dave Iverson, sitting in this morning for Michael Krasny. It was the summer of 1971, and a young Stanford psychology professor named Philip Zimbardo came up with an idea for what he thought would be an exciting research project. He called it the Stanford Prison Experiment. He built a simulated prison in the basement of a campus building, then recruited young college students to participate. For 2 weeks, half would be prison guards and half the students would be prisoners. What happened next startled the young men and Philip Zimbardo himself. Within 36 hours, the student guards were exerting their authority zealously, sometimes abusively, and some of the student prisoners started to fall apart. The two-week project was canceled after only 6 days. That singular research experiment posed questions that would continue to inform much of Phil Zimbardo's later research. Are cruelty and abuse the product of bad character, or can anyone who's put in the wrong situation commit evil deeds? And then one day, some 33 years later, Phil Zimbardo saw the stunning images come out of Abu Ghraib. And it took him right back to the summer of 1971. He thought he saw a connection between what had happened in balmy Palo Alto in the summer of 1971 and what was then happening in Baghdad. And he set to work on a new book. It's called The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. Phil Zimbardo, Professor Emeritus at Stanford University, joins us now. Good morning, Dr. Zimbardo.
Good morning. It's great to be here.
Happy to have you with us. Let's go back first, then, to that summer of 1971 and have you outline for us, what was it that intrigued you? What was it that you wanted to explore when you set up the Stanford Prison Experiment?
Well, it was a question, actually, that I have been curious about since I was a little kid growing up in the ghetto in the South Bronx in New York. Because if you grow up in a ghetto, you grow up with evil all around you. You grow up with friends who are good kids who do really bad things, end up in prison. Once they're in prison, they're going to be abused by the older guys there. And I was always just curious. I didn't have a way of framing it, but you know, how do kids that I thought I knew suddenly do really bad things? And then other kids who had seemed ordinary would do some heroic thing. So I think I just planted the seed. Psychology, when I was a graduate student, was really boring. I mean, psychologists asked small questions and had exquisitely refined techniques dealing with them. So the only C in my life was introductory psychology. So I switched to sociology because they were asking big questions about the ethics of the atomic bomb. And sociologists asked really big questions, but they never had an answer because they didn't have very good tools. So I said to myself, why not ask the sociologists questions, which are really about institutions and about power, and use some of the psychology techniques, which are controlled experiments, assessments. And so the Stanford Prison Study is really the first attempt to look at how institutions impact individuals and how individuals can, in a sense, change institutions. So the Stanford Prison Study, done back in 1971 with the help of Carla Prescott, who is my consultant, and Craig Haney, who was a graduate student then, was an attempt to say, what happens when you put good people in a bad place? So we knew on day one, August 14th, 1971, that every one of the young men who were going to play the roles of prison guards were normal, healthy, college students from all over the country who happened to be in the Bay Area then.
Because you put them through a screening to make sure you didn't have people participating who were going to be bad actors from the get-go.
Absolutely. So essentially, you have to determine in advance that these people are not bringing in any pathology. If you go to a regular prison, people said, why don't you just study San Quentin? Well, people who become guards, people who become prisoners, bring a lot of baggage with them, and we didn't want that. So after a battery of psychological tests, clinical interviews, background checks, we had 24 kids from all over the United States, even one was from Canada. And then we did what is the essence of an experiment. We randomly assigned half to be guards, half to be prisoners, with no training, because we know what it means to be a guard. It means you have power. We know what it means to be a prisoner. It means you're powerless and you're going to rebel against the domination. And then we set about creating a very realistic psychological environment in the basement of Stanford University's psychology department. And the experiment was set to go for 2 weeks. Prisoners lived there 24 hours a day. Guards worked 8-hour shifts.
And part of what's startling when you read the account of it in your book is how quickly, really, things fell apart. These 24 normal college students, as you say, randomly divided, wasn't like one was intended to be a guard or a prisoner. Within 24 to 36 hours, some of the prison guards were abusing their authority, and some of the prisoners were starting to fall apart. Was that startling to you, that it happened that fast?
Well, two things are startling. What I have to say is on day one, nothing happened. Well, we had a dramatic arrest by the Palo Alto police. I had persuaded the police department to do mock arrests. And so the students who were going to be prisoners were told to wait at home or in your dormitories, and the police arrested them. So that was a critical first step, because we wanted the prisoners to have their freedom taken away from them rather than they come to say, I'm here to be a prisoner. If they give us their freedom, then they could take it away. But then what happened was nothing. So the first day, it was just awkward. Remember, it's 1971. These kids are civil rights activists, anti-war activists. It's the time of hair. And these are hippies. And none of them wanted to be guards. I mean, we asked them before. And none of them, all of them said, you know, yeah, I'd rather be a prisoner because, you know, I might get arrested for drunken driving or various things. So you didn't have, you know, kids with, in quote, a redneck orientation. And so the first day was just awkward. I mean, you know, the guards had military-style uniforms, and they wore silver-reflecting sunglasses, an idea I got from the movie Cool Hand Luke, to make them anonymous. But nothing was happening. And then on the second day, the prisoners rebelled. That is, whatever little the guards were doing was more than these prisoners wanted to accept. And that transformed the dynamic of the prison, because the guards then said, these are dangerous prisoners, rather than these are, you know, pain in the butt college students. And that at that point, the guards said, we are going to escalate the domination control. And that's what we saw. Each day, what the guards did was create a more and more dominating, powerful environment to suppress any prisoner initiative.
And what part of what is also interesting about that, and we'll come back to this later when we talk about the connections you make to Abu Ghraib, is that this was not by instruction. You set out at the beginning by saying, we want to create a prison-like environment. We want you to exert control over the prisoners. But there wasn't a sort of prisoner guard 101 manual that you handed out. These guys created that environment themselves.
Well, see, I mean, because they were college students, you got a lot of creative evil. That is, one of the powerful motivations for evil is boredom. It's not been recognized as much. Most evil doesn't come out of evil motives. People say, I want to harm someone. It really comes out of boredom. And one of the ways you overcome boredom by is doing something exciting, something novel. That's, by definition, that's how you overcome boredom. And the guards had 8-hour shifts, especially at night, with nothing to do. And interestingly, to foreshadow what we're going to say later, is the worst abuses at the Stanford study and the worst abuses at Abu Ghraib happened in the night shift. And I think, so one of the dynamics was guards having in both places dealing with the boredom of a long, long, terrible shift by having the prisoners be their playthings.
And describe a few examples of how that took place. What sort of playthings happened?
Well, at first, the guards had the prisoners doing push-ups and then jumping jacks and then lining them up to recite the rules. There were 17 rules that the guards made up. All the rules are rules which limit the prisoner freedom. And then learning their numbers. But then we'd do counts up and down and sing counts and learn their numbers, by all kinds of devious ways. And then that got boring, and then they started, by the third day, you certainly started the sexual thing. So the sexual thing always involves stripping prisoners naked, which is part of the dehumanization. And then you make fun of their small genitals. And then it escalates to games. So you say, you're Frankenstein, you're Mrs. Frankenstein. Walk like Frankenstein. And then they push them together, hug them, say you love them. So here's the start of homophobia. And then you say, see the hole in the ground. Instead of just push-ups, F the hole in the ground. So you have prisoners doing that. And then finally, by the fifth day, the guards are saying to the prisoners, bend over, your female camels. The prisoners, their uniforms are really smocks with numbers on and no underpants. And we did that because we wanted to feminize the prisoners. That is, not have them be dominant the way that in most prisoners you want to suppress the masculinity of prisoners. And when they bent over, their butts are showing. And they say, okay, you guys line up. So the other prisoners line up behind them and say, now hump them. So it's funny. The guards are laughing. Oh, it's a play on words, camel hump. And they're simulating sodomy in 5 days. College students in a mock prison playing mock role of guards against mock role of prisoners.
And tell us then at that point what you were thinking, because there was – you played a dual role, which you also later say was a mistake that you made.
Big mistake. Oh, yes.
Between being both the principal investigator, the researcher, but also the superintendent, if you will, of this faux prison. But at that point, 4 or 5 days in, the researcher, Phil Zimbardo, is still intrigued by what you're seeing, because you're seeing something in a research setting that hasn't been done before, right?
Well, it's a mix. The problem was I kept shifting between these two roles, which are really incompatible, because if you're a prison superintendent, which I was, there was a name on the door. People treated me like a prison superintendent, parents who came. We had visiting days. We had, when I say it was a realistic environment as well as we could create, again, with the help of Carla Prescott, who had just come out of prison after 17 years, he advised me on how to create the psychological orientation that's central to any prison. So we had a prison chaplain come down, a public defender. We had parents, girlfriends, boyfriends on visiting nights. We had a parole board, which Carlo headed, but we had secretaries and graduate students. So there were lots of different people who came down and saw some of what was happening. But most of them treated me like the prison superintendent, and I began to fall into that role. So if I look at videos, I'm walking down the yard, the prison yard, with my hands behind my back, which I never do. And I looked at that, and here's this strange nonverbal behavior of authorities. It's a politician or the general walking down inspecting the troops. And that's not me.
So the likable young psychology professor,
sweet and lovable,
had become, in effect, someone who was fascinated by both the role you were playing and what was going on. But then something else happened.
I became indifferent because, in that role, if you in the role of prison superintendent, ethics is not involved. Essentially, it's maintain law and order. All I had to do was ensure that the guards did not use physical force, which I did. But I didn't limit psychological force. And when you said earlier that prisoners broke down, in 36 hours, the first prisoner, 8612, had an emotional breakdown. And every day after that, another prisoner followed suit. So at the end of 5 days, five of these normal, healthy young men had these emotional breakdowns. And when that happened, I should have ended the study much earlier. In fact, when I wrote The Lucifer Effect, I went back and relived it by watching 12 hours of the videotapes and made a typescript. And I kept saying, Zimbardo, why don't you end this thing? How could you let it go on? How could you let it go on? I couldn't understand that.
But it took someone very important to you to say just that before you pulled the plug.
Yeah. What happened on Thursday night, so the study started on Sunday. This is now 5 nights into it. This is just before that horrible incident of simulated sodomy. I was going to have a number of psychologists, graduate students and young professors, come down and interview everybody, give us a feeling, a sense of how the experiment is unfolding, people who knew nothing about the study. And they were going to do this on Friday. And Christina Maslach, who had been A graduate student of mine had recently gotten a job at Berkeley in the psychology department as assistant professor. Came down the night before. I think she had been working in the library during that day. I said, come down. We'll you know, have dinner. We had just started dating. And what she saw was, this is her first shot in the study, prisoners lined up, bags over their heads, their legs chained together, arm on each other's shoulder, and the guards yelling at them, cursing, abusing them. And I look up and say, hey, Chris, look at that. And she, you know, and she doesn't look. She looks away. And I say, hey, don't you see that? Look at that interesting behavior. And she tears up and runs out. And I run out and I'm yelling at her. I say, this is a crucible of human nature. So I'm now switching into this indifferent, you know, researcher mode. And I'm going, what's wrong with you? You know, I probably even did the sexist thing. You know, women got to, you know, have to see reality the way it is. And she stopped me cold. She said, these are not prisoners. These are not volunteer subjects. These are boys. And what you are doing to them is terrible.
And so it came to a close. And in a sense, it hasn't come to a close because it provoked questions that you've continued to explore throughout the rest of your research career, continuing now into this examination of Abu Ghraib. So let's begin to talk then some about what you take from this, because your principal argument, it seems to me, is that the line between good and evil is a very hazy line at best, and that anyone put in the wrong situation under the wrong circumstances can do evil things.
Yeah. What the Lucifer effect tries to get across to the general public is that that line between good and evil is permeable. We really want to believe that we are good people and the bad people are over there, and that we could never do the kinds of things they're doing. Well, it's easy to make that separation if we dehumanize them. I mean, they are evil, they are monsters, they are vermin, whatever. And what the prison study says, and what a whole body of psychological science says, of which the prison study is just one example, is that most people, not all, but the majority of people in a whole range of psychological studies can be initiated into evil, can be seduced into evil, can be led to hurt others, lie, cheat, behave in ways that are alien to their human, the usual nature when they are not in a new situation. And so what I've tried to do in the Lucifer Effect is to detail what are the social psychological dynamics in these situations, not only in Abu Ghraib or in the Stanford Prison Study, but how to be operating at Enron, at WorldCom, in Rwanda. And so corporate malfeasance is really no different than what happened in Abu Ghraib in one sense, or it happened in the Stanford Prison Study.
And the key point you often make throughout the book, and the analogy you often use, is that it's not a question of bad apples. It's a question of a bad barrel.
Yeah. You see, what that gets at is, in trying to understand any complex behavior, coming from a society which is focused on individualism, we locate pathology, sanity, sin, rationality in people. People get credit for success. People get blamed for failure. And it's really a medical model applied in religion, in economics, in psychiatry. And my argument is we need a public health model, which says when you see any kind of pathology, what you have to look for is what is the vector of disease in the society which is affecting the individuals who are simply actors. Because if you don't, you're never going to change it. Putting people in prison, re-educating them, punishing them, executing them, never changes the basic cause.
And what you saw when you saw those pictures of Abu Ghraib just a few years ago, some 33 years after the Stanford Prison Experiment, were certain similarities in the bad barrel, that there was a lack of training, that there was a lack of supervision, that there was an encouragement to sort of put people into the most vulnerable of circumstances. Tell us the lines, the connections that you drew between those images that we all remember of Abu Ghraib and what you had learned 30-some years before.
Well, if you remember, it was 60 Minutes, I guess 60 Minutes 2, on April 28, 2004, where they exposed these images. They were leaked, I guess, through to Seymour Hersh, and these were exposed. And what happened immediately, General Myers, the head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, got on and said, this is the work of a few bad soldiers. It doesn't reflect anything on the military. There is nothing systemic about it, meaning blame the individuals, and take the system off the hook. Well, I had been hearing that since I was a kid, when there were scandals in the New York Police Department, or we see them in most city police departments. The system blames the individual, the bad cops, the bad firemen, the bad priests, and takes the system off the hook. In fact, President Bush said, we're going to get to the bottom of this, which I knew immediately meant they're never going to get to the top of it. But I was just an ordinary viewer watching these. You know, these are inexcusable, but I realize these are not inexplicable, because there was the visual similarity to Stanford Prison Study. Nakedness, bags over their heads, chain, and the sexual games.
And night shift.
And again, all in the night shift. What's really critical, it's only in one place. It's Tier 1A, Abu Ghraib, which was the interrogation soft torture center. Well, how was I ever going to make the distinction between good apples and bad barrels without knowing more? And fortunately for me, Gary Myers, who was the legal counsel for Sergeant Chip Frederick, he was supposed to be in charge of the night shift, called me and said, we'd like you to be on our defense team. I said yes immediately, because then I could become an investigative reporter to find out everything about these apples, whether they were good or bad, and everything about that barrel. And so as an investigative reporter, I had access to all of the investigative reports, all of the 1,000 pictures, which are, many of them are much more horrifying than anything we've seen. And then I had access to this young man. I interviewed him. I had psychological tests done on him. And so I would be, by the time I wrote The Lucifer Effect, I was in a position to know almost everything there was to know about the situation that he and those other soldiers were in, who created that situation. And I could say, these are good apples put in a really bad barrel.
And in many ways, you would say also, I think, that Ivan Frederick had a whole lot in common with those college students from 35 years ago.
Oh, absolutely. What I could say unequivocally is that on day one, when he went into that dungeon, he was interchangeable with any of the good guards in my study, except, you know, less intelligent. He was more average intelligence. He was a super patriot. He had 9 medals and awards from the military. He had been a guard in a small prison, and I checked out all his records, exemplary guard. He loved the American flag. I have in the book a picture of him holding the American flag. He'd give it as gifts. He is a super patriot. He should have been the poster boy for the military rather than the fake heroes that they generated, Jessica Lynch and Pat Tillman. But instead, he goes down to this dungeon, and he's now working 12-hour shifts from 4 p.m. to 4 a.m., 7 days a week for 40 days without a day off.
Little training?
No training. These are, again, see, the military has covered this. These are all Army reservists, meaning they have no mission-specific training to be in a combat zone prison. The other thing that happens is military police are supposed to maintain law and order and protect prisoners. Tier 1A is a military intelligence CIA center, and the military intelligence are dominating the soldiers. They soften them up, take the gloves off, prepare them for interrogation.
Philip Zimbardo, our guest, will talk more about what happened at Abu Ghraib and why he thinks that took place when we return. He's the author of The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. More with Phil Zimbardo when we return. And if you'd like to participate in our conversation and have questions for him, here's how you can do that. You can call us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us your thoughts and questions at forum@kqed.org. That's forum@kqed.org. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson. And welcome back to Forum. I'm Dave Iverson. Our guest this hour, Dr. Philip Zimbardo, Emeritus Professor of Psychology at Stanford University, and the author of a new book, The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil, a book that looks back at his own experience with the famous Stanford Prison experiment, in the summer of 1971, and the connections that you can make between that experience and experimental research and what has happened at Abu Ghraib and elsewhere. One of the points you make strongly in the book on a number of occasions, Phil Zimbardo, is that although your principal thesis is that it's bad barrels that we need to be concerned about, not so much bad apples, and that it is that barrel of situations that can create evil deeds, You also make the point that that doesn't excuse individual behavior. You say at one point, let me make clear one critical point. Understanding the why of what was done does not excuse what was done. Psychological analysis is not excusiology. Individuals and groups who behave immorally or illegally must still be held responsible and legally accountable for their complicity and crimes. So how do we do that? How do we square understanding the situation that created that and still hold someone responsible for doing those deeds?
Well, it's a complex juggling act. In fact, one of the consequences of the Lucifer effect may be creating a revolution in legal theory. I just gave a talk at Harvard Law School, and a number of the professors and students came up and said, you know, that the book makes a very powerful, profound statement about the limit of current law, which says it's all culpability is all in the individual, and situations are merely mitigating circumstances. And I'm saying there are conditions under which, as in Abu Ghraib, where the individuals were not following orders. They were put in a situation where a whole host of social psychological processes corrupted, distorted their thinking. So they were not acting rationally, willfully, but they were influenced by demonization, by de-individuation, by role-playing, by conformity pressures, by a whole range of things that we know from a huge body of psychological science can make rational people do irrational things.
So what is Ivan Frederick, the man whose defense you assisted, what was he guilty then of?
The main thing he was guilty, I should say in advance, that my testimony had very little impact because military courts don't accept situational explanations. He got 8 years in prison. He got obviously dishonorably discharged, broke into a private. They took away 22 years of his back pay. He had been in the National Guard, Army Reserve, and they stripped him publicly of all of his medals to humiliate him.
What should have happened to him in your judgment? Because if he's still responsible, what would you say would have been the apt punishment?
He said all of the soldiers except Lindy Eglin said, we are guilty. Well, they were in the pictures. I mean, they put themselves in the trophy photo, so they, you know, there was no getting around it. He said, I'm guilty. I'm ready to serve. I'm willing to die for my country. But perhaps he should have gotten a sentence more like 3 years. Two soldiers who murdered Iraqis, that they claimed that their officer told them to release the Iraqi detainees, and they shot him in the back. They just got 3 years for negligent homicide. Nothing that Chip Frederick did or any of the soldiers in Abu Ghraib did anything, you know, that extreme. Nobody was killed. But I think what is important is that by understanding the psychological dynamics, we are in a position to try to change prison conditions, not only Abu Ghraib but other places. Whereas if our only concern is punishment, which is, you know, the way the legal system is set up, we don't change the situation. The Inquisition in 1486 in Catholic countries throughout Europe was about how you eliminate evil in the world, and you do it by identifying witches, getting them to confess, burn them alive, put them in boiling oil. And not only did evil not go away, it stimulated evil, especially evil against women by the church and the state. So we've tried the individual approach to dealing with crime, dealing with evil, and it doesn't work. I'm saying let's try a new public health approach in which the culpability is not only of the actor, but it's of who are the people who created that situation. And so in the book, I put on trial the generals who created that situation, Abu Ghraib, that put these soldiers in, and the people above them, the architects not only the war, but the architects of the civilian architects, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, George Tenet, who...
The makers of the bad barrel.
Who made that bad barrel.
Yeah. Phil Zimbardo, our guest. And to your calls this morning, we welcome your participation at 866-733-6786 or your emails at forum@kqed.org. Frank in San Rafael joins us first. Frank, go ahead.
Yes, good morning.
Thank good morning.
You. Fascinating topic, and I appreciate you having this guest on. I heard him speak before on another program, and I think it's wonderful information. The thing that concerns me, however, is I also heard another program, and I can't remember the name of the individual who was on that program, but he talked about essentially the Manhattan Project of torture that was done by the CIA in the early 60s. And what I was wondering about is that what they discovered in that torture research project was that holding positions to have the sensory deprivation, that these were the things that broke down prisoners faster than anything else, and that has become now the standard of use around the world. So I'm concerned when like you said, I think it needs to go. These were policies that were put in place that these folks carried out.
Frank, thanks. Thanks for the call. Dr. Zimbardo.
Yeah, there are two things. I don't remember if it's called the Manhattan Project, but in the 60s and 70s, the CIA had a program called MK-Ultra, which is Mind Control Ultra. We were concerned that the Soviets had Soviets and Chinese communists, remember that was the era where the communists were our enemy, had techniques of mind control. So we tried LSD, we tried sensory deprivation. The government funded lots of psychological research on sensory deprivation, on sleep deprivation, on shock therapy, on really outrageous things that were done on American citizens without their knowledge. And whatever seemed to work then got filtered into the CIA, got it filtered into the military. The other related thing, I think probably what your guest is also talking about, is every branch of the services have a program called SEER, S-E-R-E, Search, Evasion, Resistance, Escape, where after the Korean War, when American soldiers gave germ warfare confessions after just a day or two being arrested, all the military had training to how to resist interrogation. Well, the argument now is they've learned what techniques are used for soldiers to resist, but if you flip the coin, they also now know what makes people confess. So the argument now is those techniques have been used are being used in Guantanamo, were being used in Abu Ghraib.
And also, I suspect, I'd be curious to know your perspective on what happened with the British sailors who were just released from Iran, who within a very short time seemed to be acknowledging certain deeds that they later said were not really the case. But it speaks really to how quickly something can happen, I would think, within that sort of environment.
Yeah. See, stepping back for a second, really the Lucifer effect is a psychological celebration of the infinite capacity of the human mind. I mean, that anything any human being has ever done, we could do. So that, you know, we believe in the dignity, the willpower of the human mind, but also the vulnerability, susceptibility to persuasion. And so we have to realize that this is a very delicate organ. It's dynamic, it's wonderful, but we can be influenced in ways that we'd like to believe we couldn't when we are out of that situation. And so the first step is, before we blame people, we have to say, let me find out what was the situation in Iran that made these British soldiers confess so easily. In the same way, what was the situation in North Korea that made American airmen confess in 36 hours?
And to Mary next in San Francisco. Mary, you're on.
Oh, hi. My name is Mary Dio. I'm a student of the PGSP Stanford Consortium, and I really appreciate your guest. I've actually seen you speak before, Dr. Zimbardo. My question is actually about gender and whether or not the Stanford prison study has ever been replicated. I know it can't be replicated exactly because of ethical reasons, but if there's ever been any research looking at women and what happens when they're put in a similar situation as guards and prisoners, or what your thoughts are on that, if you think there would be any difference.
Thank you, Mary. I appreciate that. Again, it's really a complex issue. I love women, and I want to believe women wouldn't do the terrible things men do. I have a wonderful website in which viewers, readers write in, and one of the people said exactly your statement, that this is not about human nature, this is about male nature. Well, that turns out to be wrong. One of the studies done by Stanley Milgram, who was my high school classmate in the Bronx at James Monroe, included women. The percentage of women who blindly obeyed authority was the same exact as men.
And just 60%. A brief explanation, those were the
famous shock experiments done at Yale, not with Yale students, but with 1,000 townies from New Haven and Bridgeport, Connecticut, where an authority encouraged people to shock an innocent person more and more and more under some, you know, guise of we're helping improve his memory. But so in that study, women did just like men did. in Abu Ghraib, there were three of the soldiers were Army reservists were women: Lindy Englund, Megan Ambule, I forget the third one, and then the other research research where we made women anonymous, put them in a group, and invited them to shock innocent other women. And if they were anonymous, they shocked twice as much as women who were identifiable. The issue is really that men are more likely to be violent because we put them into violent situations in the police, as first responders, in the military, in war zone. So males are trained in many institutions of our society, in the competitive sports, to be violent, to be dominant. But all I'm saying is if you put women in the same exact situation as men, the chances are they're going to do just what men do. They're going to cross that line between good and evil and do some really bad things.
Sunny in Marin, you're next. Go ahead. Sunny, are you with us?
Oh, yes, I am. Sorry. Can you hear me?
Yes, you're on. Oh,
okay.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. First of all, you talked about this is a wonderful program. I can't thank you enough for having it. Goebbels knew very well about dehumanizing people in Germany during World War II, didn't he?
Yes.
And you used the word vermin, and that was one of the favorite words of the Nazis. I saw a film when I was over there, and they showed rats coming out of the sewers and likened those rats to the Jews. And it makes it much easier, doesn't it, to harm somebody or kill somebody when they're a Jap. Or they're a gook, and we're notorious in our training here in this country doing that. And I'm wondering if training in other countries do the same thing. And number two, what about sexual outlet? Does the fact that they have no organized, legalized, and supervised sexual outlets in the military. The Japanese did. They had their comfort women, and I'm not condoning that at all. But is there some way that can be dealt with properly that would not be offensive? And also, is
it... Let me just hold you there, if I might, Sunny, because you've already posed two really, really good questions. So let's get let's at least get two of your questions. First one was on training. Do we know, are there other countries that approach this, I guess, in a way that changes the barrel?
Well, let me put out a wonderful reference. Sam Keen is a Bay Area, I guess I would call him a social philosopher, who's written a book called Faces of the Enemy. And he also has a video that goes with it. I think you just get online, faceoftheenemy.com. And what he shows is he collected propaganda from around the world in which every country in the world to prepare their soldiers to kill and to prepare citizens to hate an enemy first have to create an enemy. And he shows how this creation of enemy is through visual propaganda. And having created that image, then it becomes what he calls a hostile imagination. It becomes a soldier's most powerful weapon because then you want to kill because these are the people who are going to rape your women. These are the people who are going to conquer your country. And so instead of preparing nations to be more humanized, most nations in preparation for going in war do what the Nazis did. Nazis did it more effectively than most other nations against the Jews, is prepare people to have a hostile imagination to want to kill and hate the enemy.
Is anyone doing the opposite, though? Is anyone preparing, whether it's future prison guards or attending to these sorts of situations, so that the Abu Ghraibs of the world don't take place?
I don't know. There's a very important study done by my colleague Albert Bandura in which he had college students believe they were going to help college students from another school in business solutions, and they were going to help them by shocking when they made an error. In one condition, they were told the kids from the other school seem like animals versus the kids from the other school seem like nice guys. If you say nice guys, they shock less than if they don't know anything about them. But if you use the word animals, they deliver more than twice as much shock, and over time, they shock more and more and more. So that humanizing others eliminates this hostile imagination, but our institutions don't do it because they're set up to punish, to conquer.
Phil Zimbardo, our guest, his new book is called The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. And we welcome your participation. You can call us now at 866-733-6786, 866-733-6786, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Before we get, though, to the other more calls coming in and a couple of emails as well, Sonny's other question had to do with the sexuality of that environment. And that's also really striking when you both read about the Stanford Prison Experiment and, of course, about Abu Ghraib.
Yeah, I mean, she makes a really good point. I mean, when you put soldiers in battle, in combat, and they have they're separated from their wives, let's say men, male soldiers, separated from their wives, separated from their loved ones, they go a long time without sex. And so whenever there's a chance to rape, soldiers will rape. Our soldiers rape, soldiers everywhere rape. The Japanese alternative to have slaves, you can call them comfort women, that's a nice phrase, but they were sex slaves from Korea and from China. That's not a solution. In fact, some of the worst pictures from Abu Ghraib were some of our soldiers having sex with each other. And I think that's what really got the military crazy. I mean, they're double dipping. We're paying them to have sex when, you know, sex is verboten in the military.
Email comes in from John, who writes, as a PhD candidate in sociology, I have a question. One of the effects of Dr. Zimbardo's Stanford Prison Experiment was a chilling effect it had on subsequent research in the social sciences. Mm-hmm. How does Dr. Zimbardo feel about the negative effect that work has had on some social science research?
Oh, it breaks my heart. What you should know is that the Stanford Prison Study, even though it was back in 1971, did go through the Stanford Human Subjects Research Committee, and in not using the hindsight of what happened afterwards, it was passed. I mean, these are kids playing cops and robbers. It's an experiment. They could walk out anytime they want. So there was no negative impact that the Human Subject Committee imposed. Having seen the consequence, Human Subjects Committees have erred in going too far the other way. So that in any research that it has questionable ethics, what you do is you don't say yes or no. You give a provisional thing. You say, okay, we're going to let you do it for an hour, do it for a day. We're going to monitor it. And if it seems out of line, we will blow the whistle and stop it. But now you cannot even ask questions that might upset subjects. And the subjects or participants are college students.
We should probably clarify for listeners who aren't familiar with the Stanford Prison Experiment or have read the book yet that one of the interesting findings I thought was that the students who participated in this, you kept rather careful track of. You did an extensive debriefing afterwards, brought them back many times in subsequent months, even years. And it doesn't appear that there were lasting scars. Is that right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you do any kind of research where there's any stress to subjects, it is incumbent upon you as a researcher, as a citizen of the world, to be sure that you're limiting that suffering to that specific situation and there's no carryover. When the study ended, we spent a day debriefing, first all the prisoners, then all the guards, then we brought the prisoners and guards together. I brought them all back 2 weeks later when we showed them the videos, a month later. Many of them I'm in contact with 35 years later. Some of the principal prisoners and guards who've been in interviews, TV with me. And there were no effects, even short-term negative effects, for several reasons. In the debriefing, I was able to say all of you did bad things, and one way or another. But
including you.
Including me, and I made that clear. But it's diagnostic of the power of the situation, not diagnostic of any pathology in you. Secondly, because we picked normal, healthy kids, they had this sound psychological foundation to bounce back. And the third thing is you take them out of the uniform, you give up the symbols of power, you give up those smocks, and you put them back in their usual dress, and they are back where they were. It's one of the reasons we give soldiers uniforms. Is that in the uniform, you are given permission to kill, but when this war is over, you are not allowed to wear the uniform. It's against the law. We want you to go back and be the peaceful young man or young woman you were before.
Carol's next. Go ahead, Carol.
Yes, I'm interested in knowing whether you think that there's any similar dynamic with fraternity hazing.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was in a fraternity when I was a student at Brooklyn College, and terrible things were done to me. We used to have paddling on the campus. That is, you could be walking down, and some fraternity brother would say, assume the position, and you'd bend over, and they would paddle you. You had to carry around your own weapon. And on hell night, this fraternity did really terrible things, as many other fraternities do. When I got to be president of that fraternity, I stopped paddling. I stopped that kind of hazing. I stopped that kind of extreme humiliation. Not just me individually. I got other brothers to see that this was just wrong. But fraternity hazing is a model of making some people feel worthless and powerless for a short period of time, during Hell Week or that last Hell Night. But fraternity hazing is part of most boot camp training, most training to become a soldier, most training. I studied tortures in Brazil, and colleagues of mine studied tortures in Greece. The training program to become a torturer begins with hazing, that you beat up, that the senior officers beat up these young guys who are ultimately going to become torturers because you want them to become indifferent to pain that they're going to inflict on other people.
And let's get in another caller. Ryan from Davis joins us this morning. Ryan, go ahead.
I'm Brian. I'm sorry.
Sorry, go ahead, Brian.
Hello. I can give you a brief experience of my training while I was in the military during Vietnam. And basic training, we were on the rifle range. We were shooting at targets that had the shape of a human heart on it, just the torso. And I had the sergeant shouting in my ear, "Cut that gook's heart out. Cut it out. Cut it out." And when I questioned him about, you know, teaching me how to really murder people, he said, "You have a problem, troop. I'm going to send you talk to somebody." He sent me to a chaplain, and the chaplain told me it was okay. We're killing communists.
Yeah. Brian, thank you. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. That's really – I hadn't heard that experience before. But essentially, war is all about one thing. It's about old men getting young men to kill other young men in a particular time and place. And so soldiers have to be trained to kill and kill on command. I had an uncle who was in the World War II when they used to use bayonets. And the start of the bayonet practice was you first bayoneted, you know, a straw figure, and then you bayoneted dead horses or cows so you get the sense of blood rushing out. You know, and then you had a human figure that you put, you know, and same thing. You had to put the bayonet into its heart or between its eyes. And so you become psychically numb to killing other human beings. And that's what's horrible about war.
We just have a few moments left. And so let's use those moments to talk about how you can confront bad situations. If you're in a bad barrel, to use your metaphor again, what can you do so that you draw upon your best instincts to resist those?
Yeah, the last chapter of the book, I mean, I must say writing the book was not a labor of love. It was the most painful thing I've ever done because I relived the Stanford Prison Study. While I was writing about Abu Ghraib, I'm communicating with Chip Frederick, with his wife, doing marriage counseling because they were in the process of she was going to leave him because she was devastated. But then when I get to the last chapter, I let the sunshine in. That is, part of that last chapter is how to resist unwanted influence. A lot of my experience as a psychologist has been in persuasion and attitude change. So I have a lot of information about how to resist unwanted influence. And it begins with street smarts. It begins with identifying what are those vectors of disease in any situation you're in so that you don't have a false illusion of invulnerability. It can't happen to me. It can't happen to any of us.
It starts with a moment of humility, in a sense, realizing that if you're in the wrong situation, you in fact can do something you wouldn't do otherwise.
Yeah, it's only by having a sense of vulnerability that I could be conned, I could be had, that you then say, well, let me see. I don't want that to happen. Let me see about that. Secondly, I mentioned the website. We have this wonderful website called LucifereEffect.com, and I have a whole section in detail about how to resist influence. The most important thing in the whole book, I think, ultimately, is the last part of the book is about how do we stimulate the heroic imagination. I talked about inflaming the hostile imagination through propaganda, through stereotypes, through dehumanization, through all these terrible things. We can also inspire the heroic imagination in our children. To be a hero involves just two things. One, you got to go from being passive to active. You can't be a hero without taking an action. And secondly, you have to stop being egocentric, thinking about myself, what will this cost me, and become sociocentric, care about other people or other ideas or principles. And what I'm arguing is that the best attack against evil is to promote a generation of kids who think that they are heroes in waiting, that you're going to be in some situation where some people are going to get corrupted and become perpetrators of evil. Most of us are passive bystanders. We are guilty of what I call the evil of inaction. We look the other way. But in that same situation, we don't know exactly why, for some people, it stimulates a call to action. That is, it stimulates them, A, to take action, and to be concerned, how am I going to use whatever resource I have to help other people, to help a principle, to help an idea, to do the right thing when other people are not.
And is it also, in a sense then, in that moment, thinking almost pragmatically about, how do I want to remember this? How will this act be looked upon in the future?
Absolutely. We have this wonderful example recently in New York City of a 50-year-old construction worker, African-American young man, Wade Autry, who jumps on the tracks because a white guy has fallen on the tracks. He has a seizure. 75 people are on that subway platform doing nothing. He's got the excuse not to. He's got his daughters. He gives them to a stranger, jumps on, pushes this guy away from the track, in between the tracks, and the subway goes over them. Autry and this other guy, their height is 20 and a half inches. The train is 21 inches. So there was a half-inch clearing. Had it been a half-inch less, it would have taken his scalp off. And he says at the end, I did what anyone would do, and I did what everyone ought to do. So and for me, that's the heroic message that I hope the book conveys.
And in a sense, probably also a reminder that it's only a half-inch, probably less sometimes, between a good act and an evil one.
Exactly.
Phil Zimbardo has been our guest this hour. His new book is called The Lucifer Effect, Understanding How Good People Turn Evil. Dr. Zimbardo, pleasure to have you on our program.
Thank you so much. It's been great to be here.
Thank
you. Love for him.
Again, the website, if you're interested in learning more about this project, is www.lucifereffect.com. That's effect with an E, lucifereffect.com. Forum is produced by Robin Giannatasio-Mall, Hermione G., and Kevin Guillory, with additional assistance this hour from Sharon Adam. Our engineer is Jim Bennett, and the executive producer of Forum is Raul Ramirez. This is Forum on KQED. I'm Dave Iverson.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.